Are various federal agencies investigating the political possibilities of these and similar murders? Are private citizens doing enough to protect themselves from murderous thugs who cloak their terror tactics in the honorable name of revolution, unquote? Only time will tell, but Aware, the Square newspaper, would like to hear from readers with ideas and information. We are convinced that the hate propaganda surveyed by the so-called underground can provoke violence, especially if the individual's subconscious is sensitized by drugs, fatigue, or similar influence. We offer a $500 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the killers of Sharon Tate and friends. Interesting thing for Ed Butler to say months before the arrest had ever happened of the Manson family, and here he is again in a what one might term a propaganda piece, and an editorial, certainly a piece of speculation, is coming up with exactly the story of the Manson family advanced, and how this intersects with a neo-Nazi milieu we're about to tell you. And by the way, final research credit for this article goes to Ted Rubenstein.
Okay, this is an article headlined, The Nazi and the Kid. It's an article from the Cleveland Plain Dealer for November 14th, 1982. It's written by Michael Dorgan. The subheadline is, White Supremacist Accused of Killing Boy Informant. Dateline, Oroville, California, California News Bureau. One sunny afternoon last week, local Nazi leader Perry Red Worthen sat outside his modest home and tucked his combat pants into his stormtrooper boots. He quickly summed up what he had to say about Joseph E. Hoover, age 17, shot 8 times in the head 2 days after talking to police about the distribution of Nazi leaflets at an elementary school. Quote, "He was a prospective recruit, but he was into drugs," said Worthen, age 41, the business manager of the Chico area National Socialists. "I think he got caught up in a coke deal." Worthen, a thin, tense man with pale skin, red hair, and an unrelenting facial twitch, then moved on to a topic he found more pleasant, his plans to help build a vast, quote, white flight retreat in the great Northwest. Before skipping along, let me just say that two other young members of Perry Worthen's Nazi cell, or National Socialist cell in Oroville, said that, in fact, that he himself had shot Joseph E. Hoover because Hoover had talked to the authorities about leafleting the elementary schools with Nazi propaganda.
It's worth noting also that he's planning a white retreat in the Northwest. That's very similar, of course, to the Aryan Nations.
Okay, skipping along down, it says, quote, "If they charge us," Worthen vowed, "you're going to see the best damn trial since Charles Manson's," unquote, meaning charge them for the Hoover murder. Manson, who is serving a life sentence at nearby Vacaville Correctional Medical Facility, is someone with whom Worthen is quite familiar. He says he has visited the convicted mass murderer every month since July. So enchanted with Manson is Worthen that he compared him to his number one idol, Adolf Hitler. Quote, "Both are vegetarian, both are charismatic, both have a good glare when they want to turn it on," he said, "and both love children and animals." Worthen denied that Manson had assumed an official position of power within the Nazi movement, but he said Manson has become a sufficient presence within the movement to cause a split in which the newly formed National Socialist Liberation Front embraces the Manson line. Worthen said Manson's association with the Nazis has aided the recruitment of young persons. Also aiding recruitment, he said, was Hoover's murder. Quote, "We were flooded with calls and even got offers of money for a defense fund, even though we haven't been charged yet," said Worthen. So obviously Charles Manson, who again we talked about, Ed Butler, who seemed to be in the right place at the right time for both the Kennedy assassinations and seemed to be in the right place at the right time with the right cover story for Charles Manson. Manson has now become a demigod and darling of the new California Nazis. And Perry Red Worthen, for one, is a regular visitor of his. And in fact, as we talked earlier, apparently a gift of land, we don't have the article with us tonight, but a gift of land was given by Charles Manson to the Nazis, according to Perry Worthen.
And in fact, one of the things that Joe Hoover was going to tell authorities, they thought, was that they were planning to spring Manson from prison. So again, interesting that Manson crops up in connection with the Tate-LaBianca killings, went back to Robert Kennedy assassination with Ed Butler and so forth, and that he now crops up as a leading light in the neo-Nazi movement in California. Again, a very interesting thing. Now, recall, in connection with our assassination of Robert Kennedy, that we haven't got the time to go into this in any kind of detail, but that one of the things we discussed was a man named Thane Eugene Caesar, and we looked at a fairly compelling body of circumstantial evidence indicating that Thane Eugene Caesar was actually the man who fired the fatal shots into Robert Kennedy, not Saran Saran. Now, to the two important details, and the actual documentation on this is in our guns, our Radio Free America number 9 about Robert Kennedy. The thing about Thane Eugene Caesar, the thing to remember is basically two things. First of all, he was working as a security guard at the Lockheed Burbank facility, okay? He was working specifically in an area, a restricted area, that was associated with the CIA's U-2 program. Now, this is interesting from a number of different standpoints. First of all, the Lockheed Burbank facility was connected with the Aryan Nations in a way that we're going to look at in just a second. Now, beyond that, the U-2, of course, crops up not only in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy. Oswald had connections to the U-2, but also we've taken a look at a fellow by the name of Ed Wilson, who was in charge of security for the U-2, which was sabotaged. He then was the paymaster for the Bay of Pigs, and Ed Wilson was also a protege of Theodore Shackley, the main person in charge of JM Wave that we looked at early in the broadcast. So the U-2, highly political, connected to the Kennedy assassination and a lot of other things in the CIA. Thane Eugene Caesar working as a security guard at Lockheed's Burbank facility, and specifically working in a restricted area that was associated with the U-2 project. Okay? Now, the we're going to review now a short section that we also covered in our Radio Free America number 9. And specifically, we're going to read you now from an essay, a manuscript, really, put together called The Tangled Web, An Inquiry into the Assassination of Senator Robert Kennedy, co-authored by Lee Webb and Carla Thomas. It's copyright 1977 by S. Duncan Harp. And in a section of The Tangled Web about Thane Caesar's political views, we find the following. We appear to have presented evidence to show that the official explanation of how Saran Saran shot Senator Robert Kennedy alone and unaided is so critically amiss in so many areas as to be virtually worthless as an account of the events which took place in the kitchen pantry. We have also presented some evidence to show that there may have been more than one gun fired, and that, if so, the probable perpetrator of this action was security guard Caesar. But did Caesar have a motive to kill Robert Kennedy? After all, if he did not have one, he would have been a rather unlikely candidate for an assassin. SUS Chief Houghton stated in his book, Special Unit Senator, that there were no persons of right-wing connections or beliefs in the pantry at the time of the shooting. This statement was incorrect, and if anything, the person who most put the lie to it was Thane Eugene Caesar. An admitted admirer and 68 campaign worker for George Wallace, Caesar had associations with American Nazis. During Caesar's interviews with Chirac, that's Ted Chirac, author who put together a film called The Second Gun about the Robert Kennedy assassination, Caesar revealed himself to be both a reactionary and a racist. Caesar told Chirac, "The black man now, for the past 4 to 8 years, has been cramming this integrated idea down our throat, and so you've learned to hate him. And one of these days, at the rate they're going, there is going to be a civil war in this country. It's going to be white against black, and the only thing I'd say is the black will never win. I mean, me as an individual, I'm fed up, and I know a lot of people that I work with have the same feeling. It's just that we had it shoved down our throat enough, but one of these days it's going to be shoved too far, and then we're going to fight back. First of all, I think the white man is going to try and do it with his voting power. And if they can't do it by getting the right person to straighten the thing out, then he's going to take it in his own hands. I can't see any other way to go. The blacks, the minorities have gone too far. One of these days the white man is going to get tired of, and the minorities aren't going to like what's coming up. We've had it up to here. There's going to be war in this country between black and white, and the blacks ain't never going to win." Said Caesar, "You couldn't put in a book what I think of those student protesters. They'd censor it." He further told Chirac that he definitely wouldn't have voted for Bobby Kennedy because he had the same idea that John did, and I think John Kennedy sold the country down the road. He gave it to the commies. He literally gave it to the minority. He said, "Here, you take over. You run the white man. One of these days it's going too far." In sum, Thane Eugene Caesar hated Bobby Kennedy and almost everything he stood for, and he was virulently opposed to Bobby's position on the war and civil rights, the two major issues upon which Kennedy had based his campaign for the presidency. And it's worth noting here, too, that not only was Thane Eugene Caesar a Nazi and associated with the Lockheed Burbank facility, but I'm going to read you another short section here from a book called The Yankee and Cowboy War, published in softcover by Berkeley Medallion Books, authored by Carl Oglesby, O-G-L-E-S-B-Y, and the softcover edition copyright 1976. I'm going to read you about an interesting thing concerning Lockheed security. Recall that Thane Eugene Caesar, in addition to being a Nazi, was also a security guard with the Lockheed Burbank facility. In Yankee and Cowboy War, Oglesby writes as follows. Secret Service man James Golden was assigned to Vice President Nixon in 1957. He accompanied Nixon to Russia and Central America. They got stoned together in Venezuela, meaning rocks were thrown at them. They grew close. When Nixon left the White House in 1960, Golden left the Secret Service to take a job as security chief for Lockheed. In 1968, Lockheed gave him a leave of absence to join Nixon's campaign as director of security. Recall that in our program about the assassination of Robert Kennedy, we noted that the people who sponsored the Saran family's entrance into the United States were personal friends and political allies of Richard Nixon. And of course, the elimination by assassination of Robert Kennedy paved the way for Nixon's election in 1968.
Okay, let me just point out, and I think we're running way late here, and we're going to have to start summing things up fairly rapidly. Let me just mention to those of you out there who are wondering, yes, Antone's show is coming up and will be on soon, and not to go away, just as we had people wait for us at the beginning of our show tonight because we were late on the air. Some of you kind listeners for Antone's show will have to hang on, and we'll have him here for you in just a couple of minutes.
10 minutes at the outside.
Okay, the next article we're going to read a short bit of, and we are in the final stretch here, is from the San Jose Mercury for January 27th, 1985. The headline is A Holy War Built on Hate. Again, we're talking about another contact between the Lockheed milieu, the aerospace industry, and the Aryan nations and political assassination. We just talked about Thane Eugene Caesar, and then a moment ago, James Golden, Richard Nixon's bodyguard who worked for Lockheed and left it in 68 at the same time that Thane Caesar, a Lockheed employee, was shooting, or we think was shooting Robert F. Kennedy. Golden had just left Lockheed, the same department, to go work for Richard Nixon. Anyway, again, reading from A Holy War Built on Hate. Butler, this is Richard D. Butler, looks like a kindly grandfather with a full head of gray hair and deeply lined cheeks. A former Lockheed Aeronautics engineer in Burbank, he became a racist during World War II in India when he was a U.S. Army captain on loan to the Royal India Air Force. Skipping on down, the second book, this is the second book that these Nazis take as their Bibles. The second book, The Turner Diaries, is a 1978 novel that predicts...
Again, for people who hear this on tape, we had a little bit of problem here in the studio, so it was a poorly faded out cue for the tape. The main point here being the use of Ed Butler as a disinformation specialist, first in the assassination of John Kennedy, then Robert Kennedy. Interesting enough, he's at that same press conference, and then he's following through and hearkening back to both of those events in planning obvious disinformation concerning the Manson family and their helter-skelter race war proposition. And as we've seen, and as we're going to look at in greater detail, either at the end of this broadcast or in our next broadcast on the subject, the Manson family has all kinds of Nazi connections. In a recent interview with Geraldo Rivera on network TV, Charles has a nice little swastika carved between his eyes, right where his third eye should be. It's an interesting situation.
Indeed. One other thing just to stress again about the Ed Butler article, Did Hate Kill Tate, is, again, we've talked about the helter-skelter scenario enough that it should be mentioned again that the article was published long before the Manson family was apprehended or that any of the public knowledge of this helter-skelter theory of racial warfare came out. So either Ed Butler was, once again, a pretty amazing guesser, you know, just a guy who had a real kind of a knack for these things, or perhaps Mr. Butler had a little prior knowledge.
Now, we're going to take a look at intersections between the same cast of characters that helped set up Saran Saran as the patsy for the Robert Kennedy assassination, and again, Radio Free America number 9 is the main reference source on that. Also, a lot of information in Radio Free America number 12, as we looked at earlier. We're going to take a look at the same cast of characters involved in the Manson family and portraying them as just a bunch of drug-crazed hippies, whereas we're going to see they had apparent intelligence connections. They were Nazis, many of them. Again, perhaps people who are known in the intelligence community as useful idiots, because the Manson family served as a tremendous propaganda tool for the right wing, who were able to point out to young people who may have been thinking about protesting against the Vietnam War, or in general who were taking a close look at the, quote, establishment, unquote, which is one of the operant terms of the time. And here they saw that basically if they left their homes and their mommies and daddies and set out on that road like all those rock groups were telling them to do, they might get carved into shish kebab by the Manson family.
And it certainly served as a marvelous piece of propaganda to point to the social disintegration of the country, the fact that our youth were going to the dogs and that the streets weren't safe anymore, the fact that this was not a bunch of hippies as such, but actually a right-wing group, a Nazi group, and one which, as we're going to see, has a lot of apparent connections to the intelligence community, did not come out. And we're going to take a look at some of the same people that were involved in covering up the Robert Kennedy assassination and the Manson family, and I think it'll become apparent why that information never came out.
One of the really interesting intersections is the fact that the Manson family chose as their most celebrated victims Sharon Tate and several friends of hers and Roman Polanski's. This is interesting in light of what we've been talking about, the sort of the California violences, because in fact Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski were very involved with Robert F. Kennedy's election campaign, and at a dinner at their house, Robert F. Kennedy made some interesting statements. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. We're going to read some from a book called The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, A Searching Look at the Conspiracy and Cover-Up by William W. Turner and John G. Christian. Copyright 1978, Random House, and hardcover. We've talked about the book before. It's an excellent book, and if you can get a copy, please do. This is from the prologue, and they're talking about Robert F. Kennedy's last days of his, well, not only his presidential campaign, but his life, too, in 1968. Kennedy came to California for a home stretch drive so frenetic that on election eve, this is, of course, the California primary, that on election eve he was on the brink of collapse. He had to cancel a San Diego appearance that night, but the next morning he was back on his feet, buoyed by a just-completed poll showing him safely ahead of Eugene McCarthy. After a day of last-minute campaigning, he went to the Malibu home of movie director John Frankenheimer for a quiet supper party that included Roman Polanski and his fated wife, Sharon Tate. After supper, Frankenheimer drove him to the Ambassador Hotel, where he would watch the election returns on television in the royal suite.
It would also be the last act of his life, as we know.
Indeed.
Now, again, we're going to take a look at an interesting intersection between the same cast of characters in shaping the Manson family cover story, namely drug-crazed hippies kill honest citizens. And we're going to take a look at the same group of people who gave us the cover story in the Saran situation, namely occult-crazed or Palestinian nationalist-crazed Arab shoots Robert Kennedy. As we're going to see, the same set of people were involved to a large extent in both situations. Reading now from the Los Angeles Free Press from January 23rd of 1970, this is an article called Changing Focus on Manson by Dunbar J. Van Ness of the Los Angeles Free Press. It's continued on page 2 of that edition, 12370, under the title, Will D.A. Younger Blow the Manson Case? Recall now that D.A. Younger is the fellow who fingered Saran as the lone unaided assassin of Robert Kennedy. Skipping down on the article, it's little secret to insiders that attorney Paul Caruso, C-A-R-U-S-O, is also a friend and unofficial political advisor, political advisor of District Attorney Evel Younger. Younger's campaign strategy has often been talked about and decided in Paul Caruso's home. The court chose to appoint Richard Caballero, C-A-B-A-L-L-E-R-O, an associate of Caruso, as the attorney for Susan Atkins. Interrupting that, of course, is a member of the Manson family and also the woman whose, quote, first-person account, unquote, of the Manson family slayings was the basic, was the fulcrum in the prosecution's attack, or approach, I should say. Shortly thereafter, Susan Atkins' asserted first-person story of details of the mass slayings was unfolded to a worldwide audience of sensation seekers bylined by Miss Atkins and L.A. freelance photographer Larry Schiller. We were then informed that Caruso had acted as an attorney for Schiller and was a party, according to Newsweek, to the arrangement to have Miss Atkins' story prepared for European readers. The fee for the sensational story was reportedly divided up, with Miss Atkins receiving 45% of the $175,000 price tag on her effort and 30% going to Schiller's ex-lawyer, Caruso. The balance, we are led to believe, went to the enterprising Schiller. So apparently a little bit of hanky-panky between political allies and legal allies of L.A. District Attorney Evel Younger and the people involved with Susan Atkins' defense and with marketing, quote-unquote, her account of the Manson family slayings. as we're going to see, that's not the only implication of political hanky-panky on the part of D.A. Younger himself, a high-ranking officer in Air Force Reserve, incidentally, and the fellow who grilled Saran as the lone nut, as we can see. That's a story that's full of holes.
Yeah, Evel Younger is again, somebody who has, except for places like this show, has sort of fallen from public memory since he's been out of public office. But Evel Younger, again, in the Reagan gubernatorial administration as attorney general, served much the same purpose that Ed Meese, at that time a legal advisor to Governor Ronald Reagan, has served in the Reagan presidential administration, namely the unlawful seeking to masquerade as the lawful, or at least so it appeared many times with Evel Younger. Talking now about the Manson trial and Judge William B. Keene, who is going to be referred to here, Keene, K-E-E-N-E, we're going to read an article from the Los Angeles Times of December 23rd, 1969, headlined Manson to Reconsider Plan to Defend Self. The article subheaded Lawyers Wrap Judge's Advice to Suspect. The article is by Ron Einstoss, who's a Times staff writer. Just going to read a short segment of it here. Judge Keene has never said publicly, now remember, Judge Keene is the judge of this, at this particular phase of the game, of the Manson trial. Judge Keene has never said publicly that he wishes to run for district attorney, but his name has been mentioned as a possible successor to District Attorney Evel J. Younger. Younger is believed to be interested in running for state attorney general. In trying to decide whether he should allow Manson to represent himself, Judge Keene faces conflicting legal decisions. Again, as was not known, obviously, in 1969, but Evel Younger indeed did become state attorney general.
And again, he was the fellow who was walking point on the Saran prosecution. Another interesting piece of legal leisure domain by Evel Younger. This particular article appears to be from the Los Angeles Herald Examiner from September 1st, 1969. However, it's the person who sent this to us did not list the particular newspaper. It appears to be L.A. Herald Examiner 9169. It might conceivably be the L.A. Times from that same date. At any rate, check the Reader's Guide for 1969 for Los Angeles. Tate trial gets lift from boys, the article, but that's sort of a diversion. That particular article talks about the comic relief in the courtroom. It's interesting that that particular headline overshadows an interesting move by Evel Younger. Now, recall Evel Younger's connections with Paul Caruso and Paul Caruso's connections with lawyer Caballero, who was instrumental in arranging Susan Atkins' lucrative deal to spread her version of the Manson killings. Reading from this article, the courtroom incident provided some comedy relief in a day which saw a major development with the removal of Chief Prosecutor Aaron H. Stovitz from the case. District Attorney Evel Younger, in a surprise move, took Stovitz off the case, saying this would allow him to return to administrative duties. It was known, however, that Younger has been concerned by out-of-court statements by the two co-prosecutors. Skipping down in the article, Stovitz, chief of the District Attorney's Trials Division, has been on the case from the start, assisted by Vincent Bugliosi. Stovitz was quoted by some media as characterizing the testimony of defendant Susan Atkins as, quote, a performance worthy of a Sarah Bernhardt, unquote, after she told the judge she was suffering from stomach pains. A doctor had said she was in good health. Stovitz later said he was speaking off the record. Interesting in light of the behind-the-scenes connections between Susan Atkins' defense, her PR marketing of her story, and District Attorney Evel Younger, the fellow who was instrumental, again, in having Saran fingered as the sole lone nut behind the Robert Kennedy assassination, all physical evidence to the contrary notwithstanding.
There are some other interesting intersections. One of the most interesting intersection between the Manson trial and the Robert F. Kennedy assassination is going to be touched on briefly right here. This is an article from the San Francisco Chronicle for December 8th of 1969. The headline, Manson Asked to Be His Own Attorney at Trial, Dateline Los Angeles, it's an AP Wire story. Charles Manson, bearded leader of a strange clan, told a judge yesterday he wants to act as his own attorney when he comes to trial on charges of murdering actress Sharon Tate and six others. Quote, Your Honor, there is no way I can give up my own voice in this matter, Manson told Superior Court Judge William B. Keene. Quote, if there is no way I can speak freely, it ties my hands down and I might as well not have a defense, unquote. Manson, age 35, asked that he be assisted in his defense by two attorneys, Luke McKissick and Lawrence Steinberg, and McKissick is a strangely spelled name. M, capital M, small c, capital K-I-S-S-A-C-K. Manson asked that he be assisted by two attorneys, Luke McKissick and Lawrence Steinberg, both of Los Angeles. McKissick is currently handling the appeal of Sirhan Bishara Sirhan, convicted of killing Senator Robert F. Kennedy. And the article goes on to say Keene denied both requests temporarily, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, discussing Manson's plea to be his own attorney. But for our purposes here, the interesting name is Luke McKissick, who was one of Manson's two attorneys and also was handling the appeal of Sirhan Sirhan. And not only interesting just the mere fact of that overlap, but the way in which Luke McKissick handled Sirhan Sirhan's appeal, or rather mishandled it, some might suggest.
Reading again from The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy by William Turner and John Christian. In early 1971, Bill Harper showed noted Hollywood lawyer Luke McKissick the evidence pointing toward an assassin other than his client. The lawyer refused to incorporate the criminalist's findings in his appeals case for Sirhan, then later insisted to newsmen that if there had been a second gun fired at the assassination scene, it would have been someone without any connection with Sirhan or his actions, quote, who seized on the impulse of the moment, unquote, to fire a bullet into RFK's brain. No newsman challenged that gem either. So Luke McKissick apparently was not totally sincere in his efforts to get Sirhan off the hook. And again, even Vincent Bugliosi, who took over as the sole prosecutor of the Manson case after Stovitz was dismissed, was later crops up on the Robert Kennedy case when he represented KCOP in their unsuccessful effort to resist a lawsuit by Jerry Owen, one of the principals in the Robert Kennedy assassination.
Oh, is that gone? I was going to ask you to read that sentence again if it was still there, but I thought it was just such a gem because I also wanted to make a comparison. Mind you, this man is Sirhan Sirhan's attorney. Sirhan Sirhan is appealing, as we have talked about many times. The case has more holes in it than the pantry walls, of the Ambassador Hotel. And yet, despite the manifest evidence of the second gun, this is what Sirhan's own attorney says.
The lawyer refused to incorporate the criminalist's findings in his appeals case for Sirhan, then later insisted to newsmen that if there had been a second gun fired at the assassination scene, it would have been someone without any connection with Sirhan or his actions, quote, who seized on the impulse of the moment, unquote, to fire a bullet into RFK's brain. Even if it had been on the impulse, it still wouldn't have made his client was guilty, a small feat of legal leisure domain that it seems to have gotten by the eagles of the American journalistic community.
What is particularly astonishing is because this is the ultimate devolution of both the Robert F. Kennedy case and the John F. Kennedy case. We've mentioned many times that on the House Select Committee's finally coming up for the first time since 1963 with a very lukewarm finding, but nonetheless a finding that there was a probable conspiracy in the assassination of John F. Kennedy and that the single bullet theory was impossible. The New York Times or the Washington Post, and I'm still not having tracked down which one, but one of America's major newspapers ran an editorial that suggested that in fact what that probably meant is there was two unrelated lone nuts in Dealey Plaza who just happened to be shooting at John F. Kennedy at the same time. So faced with the impossibility of the single bullet theory, the New York Times offers us two lone nuts. Faced with the impossibility of Sirhan Sirhan, Luke McKissick offers us two lone nuts in the Ambassador Hotel pantry.
And among the many people who appears to have been principally involved in the assassination of John Kennedy was a fellow named Richard Nixon, who was in Dallas, Texas on November 22, 1963, flew out right about the time Kennedy was getting his brains blown out. When interviewed by the FBI in February of 64, he said he left 2 days earlier, his memory being off by a full 48 hours at that juncture. Now, it's worth noting that as Charles Manson was standing trial, Richard Nixon, himself an experienced trial lawyer, said publicly at a news conference that Manson was, quote, guilty, unquote, thereby seriously jeopardizing the legal case against him. Manson then flashed a headline with Nixon says Manson's guilty in the courtroom, almost blowing the entire case out of the water. This is worth bearing in mind here. We're going to add a short section here that you heard alluded to in that tape, reading again from The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. Sirhan Sirhan had spent his early childhood in a Palestine torn by the Arab-Israeli conflict of 1948. His family belonged to a Lutheran congregation, but in 1956 switched to the Greek Orthodox Church and soon thereafter was able to migrate to America. Their immigration sponsors were a socially prominent Pasadena couple active in the Republican Party and, in time, the Nixon campaigns. The couple had known Richard Nixon at Whittier College. Of course, Robert Kennedy's assassination eliminated the serious political opposition to Richard Milhouse Nixon. And, of course, bearing in mind the connections of Thane Eugene Caesar, not only to the CIA's U-2 project, but to Lockheed Burbank, operational base for Richard Butler at the time, the connections between James Golden, Lockheed security chief, temporarily on loan to Richard Nixon as chief of security for his campaign, I don't think you have to be a genius or Columbo to figure out what probably happened at that particular time.
Indeed. And continuing along with more Mansonalia, this is an article from the Los Angeles Times for Thursday, December 25th, 1969. They're still on the subject, or at least the general subject still being discussed, is whether Charlie Manson is going to be acting in his own defense as an attorney. And the headline is, Tate suspect may act as own lawyer. This is in the days when Charlie Manson could be referred to as Tate suspect, and he was not a nationally known figure of fear. The article is by Ron Einstoss and Dial Torgerson, who are Times staff writers. Charles M. Manson got what he wanted for Christmas Wednesday when a judge reluctantly granted him permission to represent himself at his trial on multiple murder charges. The short, slight, bearded leader of a hippie clan smiled happily when Superior Judge William B. Keene told him he could act as his own attorney. But he was disappointed in his request to have two other lawyers act as his co-counsel. Keene told Manson, in effect, he had to do it alone or with a lawyer acting as his attorney. Keene spent almost an hour trying to talk Manson out of representing himself, but Manson, accused of masterminding the Tate and LaBianca murders, was adamant about not wanting a lawyer to handle his case. Skipping on down in the article, Manson said he had gone only as far as the fifth grade in reform school and had received no formal education since. But attorney Joseph A. Ball, who had been appointed by Keene to discuss the matter with Manson, told the court that he had found Manson to be, quote, an able, intelligent, and quiet-spoken young man. He has a fine brain and a ready, and then we're missing the last word, it's probably something like wit. Continuing, a Supreme Court decision has held that a judge can appoint a disinterested attorney to discuss the merits of self-representation, so that a defendant choosing to defend himself can be adequately appraised of the risks he might be taking. It is up to such an attorney to also tell the court his estimation of the man's capabilities. Manson smiled broadly as Ball, a distinguished attorney who was formerly head of the State Bar Association, told the court, quote, Mr. Manson is a man with a fine brain, a good intellect, unquote.
Joseph Ball's entry into the case here, by the way, that was again L.A. Times 12/25/69, is intriguing because he has an interesting legal background, and I'm going to take just a second to switch the tape over here for the benefit of those who eventually hear the program on tape, so that the legal credentials of Joseph Ball and the legal history, the legal pedigree of this particular legal eagle will come to light on the other side of the tape cassette that you're listening to right now.
The background of the aforementioned gentleman, namely, in this case, Joseph Ball. I wanted to say a couple things real quickly because this gets a wee bit complicated. Now, in an article we just read a few moments ago, it referred to the fact that Charles Manson wanted to act as his own attorney despite the fact that he had apparently contacted Lawrence Steinberg and Luke McKissick to be his attorneys. Now, the judge in the case, William B. Keene, now, mind you, gets to be a complicated cast of characters. William B. Keene is a man with eyes on the state attorney, the district attorney's seat held by Evel Younger, who has eyes on the attorney general seat, which he eventually got. Judge Keene, trying to make sure that Mr. Manson ostensibly had the best shot possible, decided to bring in an outside lawyer to be a one-time only counsel and to advise Mr. Manson on what he should do, and also to report to the court whether Mr. Manson was capable of being his own attorney. So we have, on one hand, Manson's attorneys, one of whom is Luke McKissick, a man who also managed to sabotage Sirhan's appeal by suggesting that if there were two guns, it just meant that there was another lone nut running around the pantry at the same time who just happened to have a gun and saw his eye opportunity and started blasting away. So Luke McKissick is one of the attorneys. Now, the man who is brought in by Judge Keene to advise Charlie Manson is Joseph Ball. And Joseph Ball, who we're going to talk about in a moment, turns around and says, Manson is in great shape. He's a smart man. He's a wise guy. There's no reason why he can't be his own attorney. That's, of course, giving a chance for Manson to spout his peculiar philosophy at great lengths and educate the entire world in the true seamy underside of the youth rebellion.
Right. Again, Charles Manson was a fellow who made this whole thing out to be, you know, a drug-crazed, you know, hippie fantasy. As we can see, there was a whole lot more going on there. In our tape called The Ultimate Evil, we took a look at the Manson situation, the Manson group, as an offshoot of the Process umbrella cult. A group which appears to be one of these cults which functions as an intelligence front and which is explicitly Nazi in nature. Now, the interesting thing about Joseph Ball is that he was a Warren Commission attorney, or Warren Commission counsel. He was part of the team that concocted the most phenomenal legal cover-up in American history, also something which probably should have won a Pulitzer Prize for fiction, namely the Warren Report. But Joseph Ball, an interesting fellow, again, to find cropping up in this context. An article which raises questions as to just how far the intelligence connections in this case go is from the Los Angeles Times of December 4th, 1969, an article by Charles Hillinger, H-I-L-L-I-N-G-E-R, of the L.A. Times. It's headlined, Father Became Hippie, unquote, in Hunt for Tate Clues. Parent of slain actress mingled with drug addicts, vagabonds, in four-month masquerade. For 4 months, actress Sharon Tate's father masqueraded as a hippie, trying to track down leads on the five senseless Benedict Canyon murders. Senseless here should have been in quotes. Handsome, youthful-appearing Paul J. Tate, 46, grew a mustache and beard. He mingled with drug addicts, lived in communes, and frequented hangouts of the youthful drifters and was able to pull off the masquerade better than most men. Recently, he retired as a lieutenant colonel after spending 23 years in the U.S. Army intelligence working on cloak-and-dagger assignments in various parts of the world. This, again, Sharon Tate's father. The thing that's interesting is that in the Ultimate Evil Part 1, we took a look at accounts that, in fact, Sharon Tate and others, we took a look at reports that Sharon Tate and others were themselves involved in occult practices at the Cielo Drive address where Sharon Tate was ultimately killed. It's worth noting that Roman Polanski had Anton LaVey as a technical advisor on his film Rosemary's Baby, LaVey being a person who's for a long time been preoccupied with the Nazis, has one of the world's largest collections of Nazi memorabilia. Anton LaVey also was the fellow who got the Temple of Set going under Lieutenant Colonel Michael Aquino as well, so that's an interesting connection. The fact that Sharon Tate's father was a lifelong U.S. Army intelligence officer, quote, working on cloak and dagger assignments in various parts of the world is interesting. One of the things, and this is pure speculation, this is a pure hypothesis, one of the things I wonder about is if perhaps Tate and Polanski had been involved in an intelligence effort to penetrate the Robert Kennedy campaign. Summer of 69 was an interesting summer for the Kennedys. That summer, Ted Kennedy had his political career sharply curtailed by the Chappaquiddick incident. There, again, are legal tributaries leading back to other assassinations and events, notably Anthony Ulasewicz, who showed up posing as a reporter and asking all kinds of embarrassing questions, obviously acting in a covert capacity on behalf of the Nixon White House. Mary Jo Kopechne, incidentally, had been working for Robert Kennedy's campaign. That's how she came to be at Chappaquiddick. Now, this is interesting because she had previously been a secretary of George Smathers, who, although he was on good personal terms with the Kennedy, was a longtime political opponent of theirs and a longtime political ally of Richard Nixon. In fact, when George Smathers, when Richard Nixon ran for, well, I'll start with this, the Smathers senatorial campaign. In the late 40s and early 50s, when Smathers was elected to the Senate and displaced then-Senator, now-Representative Claude Pepper of Florida, he received a lot of technical advice on his campaign from Richard Nixon, who advised him to use the same smarmy red-baiting tactics against Pepper that he had used successfully against Helen Gehagen Douglas and Jerry Voorhees as well before that. Smathers then followed Nixon's advice and engaged in a real low-down, red-baiting, mud-slinging campaign in which he referred to Pepper as, quote, Red Pepper, unquote. Recall a really eloquent introduction to The Great Conspiracy from a hardbound edition from 1947 was one of the closing elements in Radio Free America number 2. That may give us a hint as to why he was called Red Pepper, unquote. But George Smathers then went on to become a political intimate of the same kind of anti-Castro Cuban and organized crime milieu that lapped up on such shores as Santos Traficante, Orlando Bosch, Carlos Bringier, and others. In 1968, when Nixon was running for president, his Florida White House and his Florida base for operations was leased to him by George Smathers' real estate connections. So George Smathers, again, a longtime political intimate of Richard Nixon's, Mary Jo Kopechne, a secretary to George Smathers. She also was the roommate of Carol Tyler, who was Bobby Baker's secretary, one of the scandalized associates of Lyndon Johnson. Carol Tyler, incidentally, died in the crash of a private plane which dove into the sea a few years after the Bobby Baker affair. So one wonders, and this is pure speculation, whether perhaps the Robert Kennedy campaign had been penetrated by people operating perhaps out of the CLO Drive address. There appear to have been a lot of intelligence connections. Sharon Tate herself may have been involved with occult groups. And again, I'm not accusing any individual, but a lot of people may have been used for various activities. So the possibility of sexual blackmail in the Chappaquiddick affair is a very strong one. Many people feel that perhaps Kennedy had been logging some sack time with Mary Jo. The smart money has it they were both then drugged. Mary Jo was deep sixed, and quite possibly Teddy was confronted with a videotape of him in flagrante delicto, you know, doing the Jimmy Swaggart boogaloo or whatever, and Ted at that point perhaps was encouraged to not pursue the issue further, told that if he did, not only would the videotape perhaps become public, but his kids might have some accidents or something else. These are frequently how the messages are delivered behind the scenes. At any rate, that's speculation, but the intelligence background of Sharon Tate's father, her possible involvement in occult activities, the involvement of the whole set, Abigail Folger, Wojciech Frykowski, and others in occult activities reported, again, in Maury Terry's The Ultimate Evil, is worth bearing in mind. Worth bearing in mind, too, that her father, a lifelong military intelligence veteran, was going around posing as a hippie, which is basically what a lot of the people in the Manson family were doing, too.
Yeah, that's what a lot of Army intelligence and other intelligence people were doing back in 1969, interestingly enough. Well, of course, besides Charles Manson himself, there was the Manson family, so-called. The Manson family, although largely portrayed in the media as a bunch of good middle-class boys and girls led astray by Satanic Charlie, much in the way of that the entire nation of Germany is often portrayed as a nation of basically nice folk that just happened to get fooled by this crazy guy with a toothbrush mustache. The Manson family, although certainly there were probably some people within it who were just that, middle-class kids who had gotten their first experience of the counterculture and didn't quite understand what was going on, there were a lot of pretty hardcore, basically criminals, small-time and big-time drifters, and folks with some pretty interesting political kinds of backgrounds, too.
Again, in the book The Ultimate Evil by Maury Terry, which we're going to touch back on in our next program on this subject, either next week or perhaps 2 weeks from now or 3 weeks from now, we're going to go into, again, the specific Nazi connections and leanings of the Process Umbrella Cult, of which the Manson family was an offshoot. This same group, again, figured in the Son of Sam 44 caliber killings in New York, another apparent provocation in the Fritz Haarmann mode. You know, crazy nuts loose on the streets. We need more cops, more jails, and fewer civil liberties. You know, the addled-brained liberals have unleashed this horror upon us, and only a good, strong leader will help restore law and order. It's a frequent challenge, and In addition, things like the Manson killings, things like the Son of Sam killings, among the many effects of that kind of activity, it causes people to read the news. A lot of people stop reading the news when a lot of these things break. People just find it too depressing, and it also causes people to be more afraid to go out and travel, and a lot of people simply turn off and become more ingrown as these kinds of stories get more play.